From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
But I am one of a dying breed, which is why I decided to put together this collection of my work, which covers a career of more than 50 years, starting in the most intimate end of the newspaper business, small towns, local news, to metropolitan daily news, to national political affairs, and to the great canvas of the world beyond our shores. It is a career path which spanned arguably the greatest era of Australian newspaper journalism. It is a career path impossible to contemplate now in the changed and rapidly transforming media world. It has been a fortunate journey, and here I have put together a collection of observations and impressions of some of the landmarks along the way.
Jeff Kitney is one of Australia's longest-serving and most experienced political journalists. Among the papers he's reported for are the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian Financial Review. He arrived in the Canberra Press Gallery towards the end of the dramatic Whitlam years, reported on multiple prime ministers, and worked as a foreign correspondent in Berlin and London. He now writes as a freelancer in Canberra. This week, his memoir, called Beyond the Newsroom, is published, and it's full of stories and recollections and incorporates many of his own contemporary reports and analyses. Jeff Kitney joins us today. Jeff Kitney, we had the release of the Palace Letters last week, taking us back to 1975. Now, in your book, you have a rather nice story about how you learned about the dismissal of Gough Whitlam on that dramatic day.
Yes, I was one of the few who hadn't gone out to lunch that day, actually, because everybody thought that Whitlam was going to call a half-cent election and that, you know, everything was sort of going to be clear. And I was actually, I often walked up to the press gallery boxes around about lunchtime.
You were working for a Perth newspaper in those days.
Yes, I was working for the Perth Daily News, which was the afternoon newspaper. And I was climbing the stairs from the opposition lobby to the press gallery boxes, as they were in those days in the old Parliament House. And I bumped into the courier from Government House, who I had often bumped into and said good day to. And he had a bundle of press releases. And he passed me one of these and he said, oh, you might like to read this. And it was the letter, the announcement from Kerr of the dismissal of the Whitlam government, from which point all hell broke loose.
Have the Palace Letters affected your assessment at all about the dismissal, which was that the Governor-General should not have done what he did?
No, I haven't changed my mind. I always believed that Kerr had acted wrongly. I think the Whitlam government, in a way, was past the worst of its you know, difficult times. Bill Hayden was treasurer, and there was a new ministry. The government, if it had had the chance to run its term, probably might have emerged a little bit stronger. And I think that Kerr acting when he did, was. And arguing that, you know, there was no way out of this was just not correct. I also think that, you know, the correspondence between Government House and the Palace reveals an involvement of the Palace, which really is, I know other people are saying that, well, it doesn't show that the Queen directly approved the dismissal of the Whitlam government, but it certainly shows an intimate knowledge and a constant awareness of what was happening and of the possibility that Kerr would do that. It seems to me the Palace should have said right at the beginning, you have to act on the advice of your Prime Minister, which was what the Australian law officers and others had said all along.
Do you think this new debate will affect anything, will feed positively or negatively into the Republic debate?
I don't think it'll make a lot of difference to it. I think it's inconclusive. It's so inconclusive. There are two camps in Australia about whether it shows that the Governor-General shouldn't have acted and the Queen was involved and so on. And because of that, I think the camps will stay where they are. I think the most recent polls show there has been a shift towards support for a republic, but the problem always will be what sort of republic, and can there be an agreement before a referendum was put amongst Republicans about what they want? And that seems to me still unresolved.
Which has got harder in a way because people would want a popularly elected president.
Exactly. So, I think Australia should be a republic. I think the palace letters show that we should be a republic. That's my view, interpretation of them. But I don't see any great momentum as a consequence of it.
Now, you've seen many prime ministers up close during a long reporting time or times in Canberra. Who's been the best? Who's been the worst?
Hawke was the best, for sure. He brought Australia together. There's no doubt about that. I mean, I remember people laughing at his slogan of reconciliation and so on when he was running as Prime Minister. But he did, I think the thing about Hawke was he wasn't overly ideological. He really approached problems. He also, of course, had a very fine cabinet, probably the best cabinet, and I'm sure the best cabinet I've seen all my time in Canberra. So he had a very good team. And he did make a difference. I mean, there's no doubt that the Hawke-Keating governments were, you know, transformative. The worst, sadly, I'd have to say, is Tony Abbott. I mean, I think, it was a bad government. I think it came in with an agenda that it didn't really disclose before the election, and then governed very badly. And of course, the Liberal Party was deeply, deeply divided, and those divisions he wasn't able to bridge, in fact, probably made them worse. So I'd say Abbott's was the worst.
Now, we've recently seen the 10th anniversary of Julia Gillard's coming to the Prime Ministership, and she's received quite a lot of retrospective praise, but you're more critical.
Yes, I'm critical because I think she was cursed from the outset. I think the way that she took the leadership with getting rid of Rudd in an unprecedented action for the Labor Party, and then the party was divided, the public was divided, and I mean that ushered in a terrible period in Australian politics. From that point of view, I think if she had waited, if politics had gone through its natural cycle, she probably would have ended up as leader of the Labor Party and almost certainly Prime Minister, and could have made a much bigger difference than she did. I'm not saying that she didn't do some very important things, but she did some strange things too. I mean, you know, the opposition to marriage equality. I remember her extraordinary speech to Congress in the US, which was, you know, that's one of the most bizarre speeches by an Australian Prime Minister. You know, there were things that...
You mean very, very grovelling speech?
So effusive, so grovelling, so... For a Labor Prime Minister, the first Australian woman Prime Minister, to have gone and made, you know, that sort of speech just seemed to me completely wrong. There were things that she did do that were important. The carbon tax, obviously... The misogyny speech, I must say, I, being a male, probably missed the importance of that on the day. I mean, I thought it was a big moment.
You and me both.
And I think there's been a lot of retrospective rethinking about that, but it obviously resonated hugely with Australian women, and I think because of that, she's forgiven a lot of other things.
And people perhaps missed the importance, can I say, in our collective defence, because it was in the context of a crisis around the Speaker
that's right.
The government had appointed a coalition rat, as it were.
Yes, that's right. I look back on what I wrote on that day, and I wrote then that I thought she missed an opportunity to bring everybody together, to get, you know, to me there was a moment here where, you know, this was calling out for leadership, and her speech was really to one segment of the community. But, you know, I think I was wrong now in retrospect.
But it was obviously effective in the context, in that
yes.
It took the argument off in a different direction.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. Now, you had long stints abroad, and I wonder if you can just talk about the transition going from being sort of at the centre of the political debate, which Canberra reporters are, to being a foreign correspondent, where it's obviously more difficult, you're an outsider, you're less important to your sources. And also, I'm interested in the difference between London and Berlin. London would seem an easier assignment, Berlin a more challenging and difficult assignment. And why did Fairfax set up a bureau in Berlin anyway?
Well, starting with the last first, there was a bureau in Moscow, which was Robert Haupt, served there and wrote wonderful stuff about the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of Yeltsin and so on. Robert sadly died, and then John Alexander, who was editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, had to decide what to do about whether to keep the bureau open or not. He actually suggested to me that we move it to Berlin. That was because Berlin was about to become the capital of Germany again, and therefore, in a way, the capital of Europe. The European Union story was becoming more and more important. There was a lot going on. There was the wars in Yugoslavia, where a lot of the horrors of the Second World War were being revisited. And so John Alexander said, go and have a look and see what you think. I went and did a bit of a feasibility study and said, I think we should move it. And that's why we moved it.
And how challenging was it reporting there?
Well, I didn't actually notice the transition all that much because it was so challenging. I mean, it was challenging because I didn't speak German before I went there, and I had to, when I first arrived, I had to do a crash course at the Goethe Institute. But I didn't have long to think about it because the Kosovo situation was deteriorating rapidly. Princess Diana was killed, I think, about 5 or 6 weeks after I'd arrived in Berlin. There were big stories happening, but there were big events going on. And in a way, they were much bigger events than anything that I'd covered in Canberra politics. Canberra politics is pretty, inner. Here was a much bigger canvas with all sorts of things going on. So I actually found it really exciting, with the complications of not having the language and having to learn it and so on.
And one of those complications with the Diana story was that you were trapped in Germany.
Exactly. I had to register both as a citizen and as a journalist, and the authorities there had taken my passport. And when I got a call, I can't remember when it was, from John Lyons, who was then the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, saying, get yourself to Paris. Diana's... I think at that stage she had died, or she was, they knew it was going to happen. And I said, I can't go.
He said, no, why passport.
Not? Well, there must be some way. Anyway, they sent our London correspondent over, so I didn't cover that story. I'm not all that sad about that.
What was your most bizarre experience as a foreign correspondent?
Oh, during the Kosovo War, I was... dispatched to Belgrade to cover the war from there, which was in itself a bizarre experience. I actually rode in on a bus with a whole crowd of Serbian people who were going back to Belgrade. It was a very, very strange bus trip because we passed houses with MiG fighters parked in their driveways because Milosevic was trying to stop the NATO destroying his air force. So he put the MiG fighters in people's houses so that NATO wouldn't hit them, which was, meant that he couldn't use them, but at least he still had them. But it was actually at the end of the time that I was there. I was actually expelled by the Serbian authorities, deported. And it was on the night that NATO had bombed the police headquarters in the centre of Belgrade, so the city was actually on fire, when I got a knock at my door and two plainclothes, actually were security men from Central Casting, long leather coats and hats and, they said, come with us. So I went with them and they said, oh, we can't go back to police headquarters because it's just been bombed. You'll have to stay here. You have to get out of it. You have to leave the country within 12 hours. I thought, God, how the hell am I going to do that? There's bombs going off. Anyway, in the foyer of the hotel, there was a crowd partying, drinking champagne and all that sort of stuff. And somebody that I knew said, oh, look, I'll go over and somebody here I know who might be able to help. And it turned out it was Arkan, who was a notorious leader of one of the the gangs that was going around Serbia, killing Kosovars and so on. He was a protected species in Serbia, but he decided that that NATO was going to try and kill him, the one place they wouldn't do that would be in an international hotel in the centre of Belgrade. So that's where he was staying. And he was there for day and night with a whole crowd of people, including all these beautiful women that he seemed to surround himself with. He came over to me, and I was introduced to him, and he said, oh, here, you've got a bit of a problem. And I said, yes, I've got to get out of the country. He said, I'll fix it. So, and he showed me his card, his business card. In fact, he gave me his business card, which I've still got. And he said, if there's any problems on the way, give me a call. So there, you know, a driver turns up and I get in the car and away we go. It was a pretty scary trip, actually, because there was, you know, a lot of activity. And we went through one of the big towns, which was bombed by NATO about an hour after we went through. There was a bridge over the main river, which we had crossed, and they destroyed the bridge just after we crossed it. And about 2 years later, Arkan was assassinated by... I don't know. I still think they haven't ever found who assassinated him. But anyway,
better story in retrospect than living through it.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's move to the media, which you write about extensively. First, though, your own entry to journalism through a country newspaper.
Well, my father wanted me to be an agricultural scientist. He was a farmer who thought that there was much more money to be made in the science of farming than the actual doing of it. So for various reasons, that didn't happen.
And this is all in the West?
This was all happened in Donnybrook in Western Australia, which is an apple-growing town in the southwest, about 160 k south of Perth. And so I took a job in the local bank, I saw an ad in the local newspaper for somebody to write reports about the local football, which I played. And it was $20 a report. So I said, oh, I'll apply for that. Anyway, the editor rang and he said, nobody has applied for this. You can have it. So I started writing reports of the football matches. And I'd done about three or four, and he rang and he said, oh, have you ever thought of going to journalism? And I said, no. And he said, well, there's a job here for if you want it. And I took it. And that's where it all started, in Bunbury in Western Australia, which was where the paper was published from.
And you think it was a good way to start?
Oh, it was fantastic. Within 9 months of starting a cadetship, he sent me to further south to Manjimup, which was a timber-growing town, one of the sort of major regional centres, which had its own paper, which was part of the group. I was the only reporter. I had to do everything, including taking the photographs and, you know, suggesting the layouts and so on for the paper, which was printed in Bunbury. So it was a fantastic experience. You know, I just did everything from the local politics to the Shire Council to the social notes to the sport. And I learned a lot about newspapers in that process. So, wouldn't be possible these days, I'm sure, for anybody to take that course. But for me, it was, you know, fortuitous.
Now, your strong message in the book is that today's media don't serve the public as well as the media did some decades ago. Can you explain what you think happened?
Well, I think what happened was the economics of the media, firstly. Newspapers, I'm talking now about, you know, the relatively recent past. Advertising started shifting to social media. Newspaper budgets got tighter and tighter. Staff started being cut. We've now had years of redundancies. When I first came to Canberra, I think the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age probably had 40 reporters between them. I think now it's maybe a dozen, something like that. So there's been a dramatic contraction of the number of people reporting. I think the media has become more partisan. I think there's now, it's more, people more to take sides now than they did. And so it's harder to find objective reporting, objective analysis of what's going on. And of course, social media has you know, taken such a huge chunk of the market and of the readership. And social media seems to me to be, you know, mostly people's opinions, very little deep reporting. And I think in particular in Canberra, you know, we had reporters who knew the subjects. We had specialist reporters covering all sorts of issues, digging down, getting out into the bureaucracy, you know, finding what's really going on. Yeah. Now it seems to me it's almost impossible. Well, firstly, there aren't enough people to do that. People who are doing the work are overwhelmed by the amount of work because there's a lot more that's going on. Government seems to ever get bigger, and the number of, you know, the kind of stuff that has to be reported gets bigger. So you just don't have that depth either of research knowledge and of reporting that is available to the public.
Just on your point about partisan journalism, you make the point strongly in what you write that the reporting used to be more from the centre. We're talking the mainstream media here. What do you think has led to this excessive partisanship?
Well, I think the leadership of News Corporation. I mean, I think Rupert Murdoch's, you know, what his view of what should go on seems to be trickled down right through the organisation. So those papers have become more conservative, more supportive of the conservative side. So, you know, that's been a big thing. I think social media has also had an effect on the mainstream media in that people now have to get, you know, copy has to be picked up by social media, or, you know, you have to get, you know, lots of likes and lots of retweets and all that sort of stuff. And the pressure for Twitter, for example, is to be noticed. And it seems to me that people think the best way to get noticed, and probably this is true, is to have strong opinions that then people react to. And so opinion becomes more important than actual information. And so, and also, you know, the conversation is now very brief. You know, the conversation is in tiny little grabs instead of, you know, deep, considered, reflective conversation.
And opinion journalism is, of course, cheaper than investing in more reporters to do the digging you were speaking about.
Yeah, which, you know, goes back to the economics of it, that, you know, from a newspaper's point of view, well, firstly, they want the stuff to be noticed. And if it could be noticed with less people doing the work, then obviously that's a better outcome. But again, I think that serves the public very badly. I think it serves democracy very badly. You know, these are really serious challenges now. And I also think another thing is there seems to be more barriers for reporters to get through. The machinery of government now that, you know, puts walls between what they do and what the public can actually learn and what the media can actually find out seem to be now much higher and much denser than they were when I was reporting in Canberra.
I think as the media reporters have become fewer in Canberra, the press secretaries have actually become more.
Well, that's certainly true, and true of departments as well. You know, departments have armies of, not only do they have armies of PR people, but they have consultants from, you know, all the consultants industry, media consultants, seems to be, have grown exponentially as well. So the media has shrunk dramatically. All those organisations and people involved in trying to influence and shape what the media actually publishes have grown in the opposite direction.
Well, the people might have become fewer, though. You've got the 24-hour media cycle, which means that there's more time for the electronic media in particular to fill.
Yes, but I think that the 24-hour media cycle means that journalists are almost constantly, you know, at the point where they have to file something. You know, the filing pressure seems to me to be immense now.
The get it out as online fast as well.
Yeah,
as
get it online as fast as you can.
Papers.
You know, get it out before anybody else has got it. So therefore, you know, the depth of the reporting, I think, becomes shallower. There may be a wider coverage, but it's much, much more shallow, I think.
Now, just finally, you reveal towards the end of your book that your father became an MP in the WA Parliament, and we're talking the late 60s here. He was almost an accidental MP.
Like I was an accidental journalist.
What's the story of that, and what would your father have thought of today's politicians?
Well, my father was very active in the local community. He was the president of the golf club and president of the RSL and did all those sorts of things. And that part of the southwest of Western Australia had always been held by Liberal Party MPs. The Country Party in those days, as it was called, the Country Party, was trying to expand its base in West Australia. It was very much a wheat belt party. It was not a southwest farming party. And they approached Dad. The local member for the seat of Blackwood was the Speaker of the Parliament. He'd been there for about 16 years, and there was a bit of feeling in the town that, or in that district, that it, you know, he was sort of resting on his laurels. And the Country Party thought they might be able to make, you know, a statement, make inroads by winning that seat. So they came and approached Dad. I actually remember the day they came to the farm, and he was picking stone fruit or something or other, and they went down the orchard in their suits and shoes and approached him. He was absolutely flattered and thought, golly, you know, in Parliament, maybe I can give it a go. So he did, and he won the seat. But there was huge controversy about it because there was a sort of unwritten rule that the Speaker was considered to be a sort of ministerial status, and there was this agreement that the coalition parties don't oppose ministers. And Sir Charles Court was then Premier of Western Australia, and he was savage about it and treated my father appallingly when he was in Parliament. My father found the whole thing horrible and, you know, decided after 2 years in that he wanted to get out and left at the subsequent election. But in terms of today's politics, I think he wouldn't recognise the National Party as the party that he joined in the 60s. It was a farmer's party. It was a rural party. It wasn't a regional mining industry, you know, influenced party. I think he'd be appalled at the behaviour of certain people in the National Party these days. I think he'd be turning in his grave at the thought of what's happened to the Country Party that, you know, as it was when he was there.
Geoff Kitney, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast. And that's all from our podcast today. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another episode soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.